Support for NPR podcasts comes from A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's been a week of quick hellos and long goodbyes, natural disasters, and jihad at home. Vice President Dick Cheney, feeling the heat, dropped into Baghdad to press the Iraqi parliament to skip its summer vacation.
I do believe that there's a greater sense of urgency now than I'd seen previously.
Six would-be jihadis rounded up in New Jersey, allegedly ready to attack Fort Dix.
These people were ready for martyrdom. They spoke about martyrdom extensively in the tapes. They said they were to do this in the service of Allah.
And Britain's Tony Blair said he tried his best on Iraq and is now stepping down.
I may have been wrong. That's your call. But believe one thing, if nothing else. I did what I thought was right for our country.
Joining us today to look at the news of the week from Philadelphia, Trudy Rubin, globetrotting foreign affairs columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Trudy, great to have you back. Thanks for being here.
Very nice to be here.
From Culver City, California is Roy Seekoff, founding editor of the Huffington Post, the online news website. Roy, welcome. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine, just out with his new book, Age of Betrayal. Jack, good to have you.
Hello, Tom, Trudy, and Roy.
Let's dive straight in with some tape here. Pentagon, yesterday, there's President Bush signaling that he may now be willing to set out benchmarks for progress in Iraq as part of a new war funding bill.
One message I have heard from people from both parties and is that the idea of benchmarks makes sense. And I agree. It makes sense to have benchmarks as a part of our discussion on how to go forward. And so I've empowered Josh Bolton to find common ground on benchmarks.
But the bill passed in the House yesterday may or may not be that common ground. Here's Representative David Obey, Democrat of Wisconsin and House Appropriations Committee Chairman, saying the bill, which gives money in two stages, depending on what happens, says it's a good compromise.
It's a fair, square deal. The administration gets a straight shot at what it wants, and war critics get a straight shot at what they want. That, to me, is eminently fair.
Trudy Rubin, a fair, square deal. Are we getting fair, square talk at last, maybe, or not, on Iraq?
No, I think the sides are as far apart as ever. The president is talking about benchmarks, but the administration set out benchmarks months ago, and the problem is they're not met. The Democrats want to set a specific timeline, a first tranche of money until July, mm-hmm. and then if benchmarks aren't met, you know, who knows if a second funding bill would be passed or what it would contain. What the president's unwilling to do is tie the benchmarks to penalties. And the problem that both sides face is that the Iraqi government really isn't capable of delivering for many reasons, because of the way it's set up, because of the sectarian conflict where neither side really wants to deliver. So I think that there's still miles apart, and I personally think they're not talking about some of the things that should be talked about to do in Iraq that really are crucial.
Such as?
Such as I've felt for quite a while that if moderate Republicans were going to go to the White House, as they did this past week, mm-hmm. and even conservative Republicans, what they should be talking to the president more seriously about is the need to try to go to a bipartisan basis based on the Baker-Hamilton Iraq Study Group. And what that does is put a heavy emphasis on regional and international diplomacy. The administration has sent Condoleezza Rice to regional talks just recently in Egypt, where she famously missed the Iranian foreign minister at a dinner party. But there hasn't really been a strategy behind that. And I think at this point, it's going to take more cooperation by the neighbors in order to get their proxy players inside Iraq to compromise with each other. The neighbors are not on board because they don't think the U.S. is serious about negotiating and they think the U.S. is leaving. And so the whole thing is designed for failure. And I think they have to go back to regional and maybe international diplomacy as the key here. And neither the Republicans nor the Democrats, except for a few people like Joe Biden, are making this a premise of cooperation with the White House.
Roy Seacoff, what do you see in that meeting, famous meeting this week on Tuesday, of nearly a dozen moderate Republicans with the president and Condoleezza Rice and Karl Rove? They said, Mr. President, you've got to do something. He comes out and says, well, I'm open to benchmarks. But at the same time, his generals are saying they want more troops ready to go longer for the surge to go into 08.
Yeah, well, first I thought it was very interesting that there was these echoes of 1974. You remember when Goldwater and the wise men of the Republican Party went up there to tell Nixon that his time was up. This wasn't
quite
that dramatic.
Time to resign, Mr. Nixon.
Yes, exactly. It wasn't quite that dramatic. But the interesting thing that I thought that came out of it was you had this very frank discussion. And then what the buzz that came out of it was Karl Rove was upset that the people at the meeting had talked to the press. So the focus immediately shifted away from the nuts and bolts of what they had said to the president to this, well, they shouldn't have spoke. Why did they talk? You know, Rove is a genius at spinning the topic away from what they don't want to talk about and onto what he did want to talk
about. But remind us of what we know about what they did say. This was a very tough, candid talk, gloves off by all accounts.
Absolutely. And this was really the affirmation of something that we've been saying for a long time, is that Iraq is no longer a right versus left issue. It's not liberals versus conservatives. The tide has turned, and I think really it's just a matter of timing now.
Jack Beatty, these Republicans saying to the president, you've got to do something quick. Our support is crumbling in our home districts. We need something to move here. You don't have forever.
You don't have forever. I'm looking at a map of the president's approval rating averaged between January and April. There are only two states in the nation, Idaho and Utah, and slightly Wyoming, where he is above 50%. His approval rating everywhere is below that, all through the South, in Texas, everywhere. Now, that means something for Republicans everywhere. He's not going to be on the ballot in 2008. But I met a Democratic congressman at the airport recently and was talking to him. And he says, if you talk privately to some of these Republicans, they're afraid of losing 100 seats if this war is still on. I mean, that's their panic scenario. And the Bush unpopularity and the unpopularity of the war, the Democrats are going to try to hang this around the Republican Party. And they are worried. And what they were really saying to the president was, do better PR, Mr. President. I don't think this was about changing policy. I think this was, they were telling him, you have no credibility on the war. Don't you talk about it. Quote General Petraeus. So what does he do? He goes to the Pentagon the next day and in 15 times in a short speech, quotes General Petraeus. So this is about these Republicans frightened of losing their seats, and well, they might be, to judge by the polls.
But there is a feeling of potential end game here when Republicans tell the president he cannot count on GOP support for many more months. And then, of course, on the other side of the Atlantic, a longtime ally in that war, Tony Blair, says he's stepping down in June. Here's a little tape. He said he did not regret his decision to take the UK to war in Iraq.
I decided we should stand shoulder to shoulder with our oldest ally. And I did so out of belief, and so Afghanistan, and then Iraq, the latter bitterly controversial. And for many, it simply isn't and can't be worth it. For me, I think we must see it through. It is a test of will and of belief, and we can't fail it.
Roy Seacoff, Tony Blair put an elegant gloss on the war in Iraq again and again at President Bush's shoulder. What does it mean to Bush, to the war, to the sort of U.S. posture in the world, to lose this particular ally?
Yeah, I mean, he went for this Churchillian flourish there at the end. Never give up, never give up, never give up. But I think the truth is, and it's sad, that I think Blair's legacy is going to be this situation where he backed up Bush all the way and at the end of the day was really a great enabler of the war. I mean, without Blair, Bush wouldn't have had the same international credibility. He could say it wasn't just Mongolia that was going along with the coalition of the willing. And it was Great Britain.
Trudy?
I think Blair's legacy will be bigger than that. I think Blair was the genuine article, that he really believed in what he was doing. Blair gave a speech in Chicago at the time of the Kosovo intervention in which he was willing to use ground troops if necessary. And the speech was about humanitarian intervention, a subject that used to be widely discussed but nobody talks about anymore because its time seems to have come and gone after the failure in Iraq, which, of course, was for many reasons. But Blair, I think, really believed in the idea of intervening for human rights reasons. I think that he probably had much more serious and broad scheme of thinking about going into Iraq. I think that he
But the
would
same intelligence, remembered. The same sort of evidence presented to go there.
I hate to disagree, Trudy.
Roy?
Yeah, I think that this was a man who had a clearer schema of what he thought he was doing. It may be that he will be proven wrong in the case of Iraq for his idea of going in this way, but I think he was a more coherent thinker, and I think his ideas will be debated long after his prime ministership.
Clearer schema, same pileup. What do you say, Roy?
Yeah, I mean, I think he was more articulate, but we can't deny that he was one of the top salesmen for this war. He was pitching sexed-up dossiers. He was pitching the yellow cake from Niger. He was pitching the specter of chemical weapons raining down within 45 minutes. So he was a very, very big enabler, a very big part of the push to go to war.
And is heir apparent, Gordon Brown, will he step back from Bush, from Washington, from the war itself?
I'm not sure. I think he will. I think the tide has clearly turned. And even Blair, when he says, you know, that's for you to judge, I may be wrong.
Trudy, take us to those the half dozen would-be jihadis in New Jersey. Is this a one-off thing, another kind of oddball arrest, or is something else going on here?
I've been surprised that something hasn't happened like this before, because it's clear that low-tech attacks, especially if they should be synchronized, as al-Qaeda usually does, and there's no indication these guys had any connection with an outside group, but low-tech attacks can do tremendous damage psychologically and economically. I think the assumption has been that outside terrorist organizations like al-Qaeda wanted to trump what happened with the World Trade Center. But I've been surprised that homegrown haven't tried it here as they have in other countries like Britain, and that there hasn't been this new approach. I think what was fascinating about the Fort Dix group, apart from the question of entrapment, but they come from a community that is very pro-American, the Albanian emigre community. That's a community that we rescued during the Kosovo War and whose welfare we fought for. And I think most of their relatives are shocked. So, again, you see that you can have some misfits for their own reason doing something. And, again, we don't really know how much they did yet. And there's questions about entrapment, but you can see that it doesn't even take any support in a community. They were basically outliers. So I think it's something we have to expect more of.
Roy Seacoff, how do you see it? The awareness was there. I mean, they took the video to the Walmart or wherever it was to get it made into discs and on there.
Circuit City,
and they're saying something like, you know, we're only a half dozen, but we're crazy, and crazy guys can do a lot of damage. I mean, the word is out. It may not be al-Qaeda, but there's a germ there that travels.
Yeah, but, I mean, in this case, Tom, this was really the gang that couldn't jihad straight.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't mean to say that it's comical, but it has this resonance. We've seen this before. This is another case of deja vu. I mean, remember the super deadly plot to blow up the Sears Tower that turned out to be a bunch of homeless guys down in Liberty City
with the
FBI feeding them the lines? This feels very much the same way. I mean, this follows a pattern, you know. We get the big announcement, terrorists arrested, oh, my God, we've foiled the plot, we've saved your life, forget about Bush's low approval ratings, and then, oh, it turns out, maybe they were not so terrifying, and suddenly the FBI was feeding them the information, and by the end of the run, there was really no there.
Jack Beatty, gussied up for prime time or something to really be concerned about?
Well, in theory, something to be concerned about. I mean, I heard Senator Lieberman asking questions of the FBI yesterday, and he was basically saying, what radicalized these people? But, you know, when crime is committed or, you know, strange things are done, you don't necessarily have to go to political motives. You don't have to, sure, there are political motives, but these people sounded like they were a little loopy. And the whole thing does seem strange to me. What I'm afraid of is any kind of backlash against Muslim Americans from these sorts of things. And already I see Tom Tancredo is annexing this incident into his, you know, anti-illegal immigration stand. And I'm afraid we may hear more of that. That's what really bothers me. I don't think these people are really going to be able to bring this off.
Trudy, I heard you there.
Oh, I was going to say that in a way, I think that this case, however the details turn out, shows that you can't brand an entire community. I mean, after all, three of the participants, as I said, are Albanian Americans. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what we're reading is stories about the Albanian American emigre experience, hardworking, grateful to America. In fact, the Albanian emigres came through Fort Dix, the refugees from Kosovo. Mm. And so wow. Families and community are shocked at this. So I think it's a lesson, a twofold lesson. One, that you could have a small group of people, and even if they're the gang that can't jihad straight, you have to remember that in the first World Trade Center bomb, the reason that the people who did it were found out is because one of them went to the rent-a-van place wanting to get his deposit back. Right, I mean, how cuckoo is that? But at the same time, we're seeing that they come from a community that is tremendously pro-American, hardworking, and Muslim. So you get two messages here.
Cuckoo, maybe, but also a kind of virus. I mean, if they had got the guns, the rocket-propelled grenade, if it had happened, hate to think about it. Let's turn to our listeners. Kevin is calling from St. Matthews, South Carolina. Kevin, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I appreciate you taking my call.
Good to have you. What do you think?
I got a couple of things I want to say. One thing the lady mentioned a while ago about Tony Blair and a humanitarian mission over there is things aren't going too good with the humanitarian mission with 65% of the Iraqi Shiite and Sunni together. Looking back on Saddam's reign as the good old days, it's not... And things not going too good. That's one thing. And another thing, I've been a Republican all my life. I've voted Republican in every national election. And the Republicans, the grassroots Republicans, want the American troops out of Iraq over there. We're tired of this war.
Do you feel President Bush getting ready to do that or move in that direction or not, Kevin?
No, he's not going. He'll ride that horse till it falls into the ground. But he's going to be the Republican, the grassroots, the Republican people, voters are going to change. They're going to do something different. It's going to surprise a lot of them.
Kevin, we hear it. Yes, Trudy.
I just want to say about the Tony Blair thing. Obviously, Iraq has become a total disaster. My argument about Blair mm-hmm. is that I believe, contrary to, say, Karl Rove or some of the explanations being given for the war by American officials before or since, that Blair really was convinced of his arguments. He has fought massively to fight poverty in Africa. He has tried to lead the way on global warming. He wanted Bush to work hard for a peace settlement between Israelis and Palestinians. I think he had a global schema that he believed in. It may have gone all awry, but I think there was more sincerity at the beginning than in amongst many of the officials here.
Hand on heart, he said yesterday.
Yeah, and it's important to understand his reason for it. He told sympathetic reporters that he joined us, quote, to keep the U.S. in the international system, end quote. In other words, if Bush had done this all alone, he was afraid that everything since 1945 would have been torn up and we would have been seen to be a kind of outlaw state marauding around the world. And he said that couldn't happen. It was unthinkable, quote, that the United States should be outside the international system. And people have said he's brave for that. The Daily Mail said it. But when you think about it, when you think about the logic, as a friend of mine, a British writer, put it, the logic is, you know, my big brother is a crazy kind of guy. On Saturday night, he likes to get drunk and ride through the town at 90. It would be bad for peace and security if he acted alone, so I'll go along with him for the ride. That seems to be the logic.
No, but he pushed for a second UN resolution, and he made Bush commit to try to get it. Of course, Bush didn't get it, and then he still went along.
We've got listeners who want to jump in here. Hamilton in Stanton, Virginia. Hamilton, you're on the air.
Hi, Todd. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
You all discussing Blair leaving and its effect on Iraq, and I think it might be a good thing in that Brown, the Chancellor of Exchequer, is probably going to succeed him.
Gordon Brown, yeah.
Gordon Brown. He'll probably take a more economic and practical approach to Iraq rather than Blair's idealistic approach, which hasn't done much.
And what would that look like if Brown is more pragmatic? I mean, the British troop levels are down some already. Does it really matter where the U.K. stands now? We're in.
I think he'll probably, as his influence on Bush, I believe he's already met Bush, he'll probably continue to probably give input to Bush, probably as Leonard does. And hopefully that'll help guide the United States and the rest of the coalition, maybe.
Hamilton, thanks for that. Let me hear from Dick Cheney in Baghdad for just a minute here. Here he is talking with U.S. troops there, explaining why they're going to have to serve longer deployments, which have been stretched from 12 now out to 15 months.
Because of your willingness to serve today, our children and grandchildren will grow up in a better world, and you will be proud of your service for the rest of your lives.
Roy Seacoff, we've got a kind of changing of the guard, not just in the U.K., but in France, talking about the international system here. Is the U.S. going to be more alone than it's been?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the coalition of the willing to go along has been decreasing exponentially. It was interesting when you couldn't hear this on the radio, but the steam coming out of Dick Cheney's ear during this trip was you could see it. He flew over there to basically say, guys, we're spending billions of dollars. We're losing thousands of lives. And you guys want to take a two-month vacation?
Guys as in Iraqi parliament guys.
Yes, the Iraqi parliament is planning on taking a two-month break. And so this also gives a bit of a tragic comic feel to what's going on over there. You know, we're pouring more money in, we're pouring more soldiers in, the surge is going hard, and they're taking a two-month break.
Let's go to Paul in Bluffton, South Carolina. Paul, you're on the air.
Yeah, I just wanted to make two points. One in reference to the attack at Fort Dix, for lack of a better description.
Or the alleged planned attack, yes.
Yes. I think, you know, both are significant in as much as, you know, it was trumped up by the media, but it is also something that we should be concerned about because, you know, we are bringing this, you know, we are fermenting this hatred and these kinds of acts within our own country by what we're doing internationally. And I think that's a great concern. However, the press is also an enabler in as much as they are, you know, helping to enhance this, you know, threat. And it is also a little reminiscent of, you know, during the last election and the presidential election, where we were getting these terror alerts. I was in New York City at the time. Mm-hmm. And we were getting these terror alerts leading up to the election. And that is, you know, also fermented by the press. And then one last point about Blair and Bush and all these people. It's a more philosophical take, but, you know, true leaders and people who have leadership always lead us from uncertainty and chaos and confusion. They never lead us into it.
Away from uncertainty. Trudy, I mean, a couple of things there. You know, one, what about the idea of international circumstances, Iraq War Case 1, engendering this kind of problem in the United States? No link to al-Qaeda, even the law enforcement says, but these guys certainly had this on their mind, and I think you've heard rumblings of other potential cells like this, kooky or not.
Oh, I think there's no question that we are in a period where there are going to be people thinking about this. And even if we pulled out of Iraq tomorrow, someone mentioned before, the germ is in the air. And I think it is there. And even if we, pulled back from the Middle East, the germ is there. So I think that it is very likely that there would be other wannabes who would try this. The question is how skilled they would be. But there's another issue that the caller raised, which I think is very important, too. How much publicity do you give? Are we creating a culture of fear? And I think that that is a very hard line to find.
For the government or the press or both?
For both, because as one of the callers said, there is an issue there. We have to be aware of it. On the other hand, you don't want people walking around looking over their shoulders all the time. But, for example, there could be a bomb in a mall on any day. So what do you do? Do you start checking cars like the Israelis do now, when you drive into a car, you have to put a mirror underneath? Or probably not. You have to live your life, but you also have to support more coordinated policing, more information sharing between agencies, better training for first responders, et cetera, because these are real issues, and probably we will face attacks on our soil, small or large. And at this point, I think that the germ is in the air, and it doesn't matter if we pull out of Iraq or not. It started before that, and it will continue after that.
Let me take a call from Mudafa in Quincy, Massachusetts. Mudafa, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you think?
I have questions which has been given by some Iraqis. I'm from Iraq myself. The first question they have is, who's the boss in Baghdad, Maliki or General Petraeus? So, second question is, Diyala province, most of it is under the control of Al-Qaeda. Why they don't move to undermine that control? And the third question is, if two-thirds of the suicide bomber from Iraq, if the most insurgency getting the finance and the weapon from the Arab Gulf, especially Saudis, why Dick Cheney or George Bush doesn't pressure the Saudi government at least to restrain their religious scholar, about 38 of them, issue a fatwa to kill American and Shiites in Iraq? Why they don't do that?
Three tough questions. And Dick Cheney, of course, very much on his agenda on this trip is Saudi Arabia, Trudy.
I think all of them are very important questions. I think at this point the United States is not in a position to dictate the leadership. Many Iraqi friends, I was just talking to one in Baghdad yesterday, have said to me, my God, Maliki isn't performing. Why can't you do something? Change the leadership. Well, the fact is, the U.S. isn't occupying, even though they're the big power behind the scenes. And I don't think the U.S. is going to get into that now, because there's no way they can impose leaders anymore.
But isn't that what benchmarks are all about, is imposing something, at least a timeline,
yes,
kind of
but
performance review?
To me, benchmarks are sort of, they're nice. They're nice for everyone in Congress to feel good. But the fact is that the way the system in Baghdad is set up, Maliki doesn't control his cabinet. The jobs are parceled out by political group. He's from a small party. It doesn't have its own militia. He cannot impose. He could probably do better, but he has a disorganized government. The benchmarks are probably not going to be met. But what I think the U.S. can do is get the neighbors to do more. And that's what this caller was talking about.
We're looking at a week in the news, from jihad in New Jersey to the president and benchmarks to Blair, tornado and fire. Trudy Rubin of the Philadelphia Inquirer is here. Roy Seacoff from the Huffington Post and Jack Beatty. It's also been a week of Katrina echoes, big box office, and a happy ending or beginning in Northern Ireland. A tornado wiped out a Kansas town. Governor Kathleen Sebelius said National Guard resources were short because of the war.
About 50% of our trucks are gone. Our front loaders are gone. We're missing Humvees that move people in and out. And we can't borrow them from other states because their equipment is gone.
Spider-Man 3's first weekend box office receipts came out at a record $382
million. Everybody needs help sometimes, Peter. Even Spider-Man.
And a new political era of power sharing in Northern Ireland. Here's Protestant leader Ian Paisley.
It's a sad day for those who were the innocent victims of all the troubles we've had. Yet it is a special day because we're making a new beginning.
Roy, this OxyContin story is kind of amazing. $600 million plus fine. The makers knew that this thing was much more addictive than they were telling people, and still they kept putting it out there. It has a kind of snake oil sound from the 19th century. We don't expect to hear this now, or should we?
Well, I think we should. This is not surprising. The Food and Drug Administration is notoriously turning a blind eye to and letting the drug companies kind of dictate what's going on. We saw it with the Vioxx. You know, we had all of the memos from Merck showing that they knew that it was dangerous, but they still went ahead with it. Again and again and again, we see this.
Jack, what do you think? Here's, you know, everybody piled on Rush Limbaugh, and of course, many people went to jail for commandeering prescription counters in drugstores. But here we had a company legally selling a drug that was dangerously addictive when they knew it. Come on, come and get it. And then, you know, devil take the hindmost.
Yeah, and of course, we hear from people that we have excessive regulation in our economy, and we really need to let the free market decide. Well, that's what happens when people don't fear regulation. Of course, the FDA now, in this bill that's passed the Senate, is going to be, quote, reformed. They are going to look at the future performance of drugs, not just allow them on the market and then wash their hands of it. That's important. But, you know, we've also seen in recent months the sheer power of the drug lobby. This week, they defeated an effort. The Democratic senators had run promising that people could buy prescription drugs in Canada, take them across the border. The drug lobby defeated that earlier. They tied up the Democrats' effort to require the government to bargain down the price of prescription drugs for senior citizens. The drug lobby, even with these scandals, remains immensely potent. And so long as we have government by campaign contribution, I think that'll continue to be the case.
Roy Seacoff, you're in California. I want to come to you on this weather front. I mean, we heard it at the top of the hour in the NPR news, and it's everywhere, but we've got fires in L.A., fires on Catalina Island and all that big picture, the huge tornado in Kansas, fires in Florida and Georgia and flood in the Missouri. What is going on here? We're not scientists sitting here, but do we have worse weather, or are we now, is the media sort of knitting everything into a, you know, doomsday global warming end times narrative when it comes to weather?
Yes, I will not be going to Catalina this weekend.
No, there's no question about that. Thank you, Marge.
I think that it is. I think it's a little combination of both. I think we are much more aware of it, but I think we're going to have to get into the understanding that we are entering the era of extreme weather. There's the fires, the super hurricanes. And I'm not a scientist either. Don't even play one on television. Mm. So I can't say if it's a product of global warming or not. But I think it's something that requires our study and our and I think what happened in Kansas is particularly interesting. That's the collateral damage that's coming from the war. Again, this is the echoes of Katrina.
On the National Guard front, you mean?
Yes, the National Guard front. You notice the thing that struck me as sort of interesting was both times there was very strong blowback from the Bush administration towards the governors, both women, both named Kathleen.
And the minute they peep that they're not getting the right support from Washington, what?
Well, out comes Tony Snow to say, hey, there's lots of stuff available. That was my favorite quote. There's lots of stuff available. Meanwhile, they're missing the equipment. They're missing the manpower. And it's very scary, particularly living out here in Los Angeles where earthquakes are constantly in the back of our minds. What would happen in that kind of disaster? Are we ready? Are our first responders able to actually respond?
Trudy Rubin, look south with us for a moment. The Pope is in Brazil, big Catholic country, big rainforest too, or was. But what's the message he's taking there? One of his first big high profile trips.
It's very, very interesting. The Pope on this message, on this trip, first of all, seemed to give out the message that politicians who supported legislation, this was in Mexico, which would allow abortion, would automatically be excommunicated. That language was corrected today. In Brazil, again, coming out very strongly against any permissibility for abortion. And there was actually an argument going on with senior officials in the government of Lula da Silva. And Lula da Silva talking about the health of the mother. Now, this is a heavily Catholic country, but it's a country where they've made great progress in fighting AIDS by giving out condoms, which the church is against. So I think it shows the tensions that we can expect between a conservative pope, even in Catholic countries, where there are leaders trying to deal with real social problems on the ground.
And Trudy, turn to Northern Ireland for a moment. We heard Ian Paisley's voice there. He and Martin McGuinness now in this power-sharing agreement. Tony Blair, again, hugely instrumental in that.
Yes.
How optimistic are you as this new scenario opens up in Northern Ireland?
Well, first of all, I find it so tremendously heartening. I grew up in Dorchester, in Boston.
You did? When it
was Irish country.
Yes, absolutely.
I'm from Dorchester myself.
It's such a pleasure to say Dorchester. You know, I give up the accent when I'm out of town,
right.
But my family still lives up there.
Yeah.
And at the time I grew up, it was about a third working class, lower middle class, Jewish, and two-thirds Irish.
Yeah.
Every bar was collecting money for NORAID. At a young age, I said, this is an issue. I'll never have anything to do with this as a journalist because it's hopeless. So I took on the Israeli-Palestinian issue, which I've covered for 30 years. So it is so satisfying to me. And I only went to Ireland after I married an Irishman. You're right. Fell in love with the place, went to the north, interviewed the whole cast of characters. And to me, it's a lesson in how leadership matters. Even Paisley understood this was the best deal they were going to get. The Catholic population in the north is increasing, so the demographics were not favorable. The economics of the south are so wonderful. Why wouldn't the north want to have that kind of prosperity without fighting? And the hard men like Martin McGuinness, understanding that you couldn't fight and talk. This is a lesson that Yasser Arafat never learned. The demographic issue that the Protestants recognized as one that Israelis have to cope with. If you couldn't do it in Ireland, you couldn't do it in anywhere. And so I'm so glad they did it, and I hope some of the lessons will rub off in the Middle East, although probably unlikely.
A bright spot right there. We'll take hope from it. Let me get a call from Meriden, Connecticut. Charles is on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to give my two cents about the OxyContin situation.
Please.
I certainly don't condone anything that the companies have done, but as someone who has to deal with chronic pain every day of my life, it's been a lifesaver.
Are you still on it? How long have you taken it, Charles?
I'm still on it. I've taken it for about 3 years. I take a small amount, which is the same amount that I took from the very beginning.
Here's the U.S. Attorney John Brownlee, and let me just ask you, you use it, Charles, but he said with its OxyContin, Purdue Pharma, the company that makes it, Purdue unleashed a highly abusable, addictive, and potentially dangerous drug on an unsuspecting and unknowing public. So is that you, or you're saying, I've got to have it?
I'm saying that it's a time-release pill, and if you don't abuse it, you don't chew it or chop it up and snort it or whatever else these people are doing. It's a very efficacious drug, and it doesn't cause me to be spaced out. It's the only thing that can help me get through the day. So I think it's, a disgrace what the company's done in marketing this, and I certainly don't want to see our teens out there abusing the drug, but it concerns me that it might be taken off the market where it has an important role to play in pain relief for people like me.
We hear it loud and clear, and I don't know if there's another shoe to drop there or if it's already been pulled back some. Roy, Jack, Trudy, does anybody know what comes next for this particular drug and maybe Charles' access to it?
I just don't know. I don't know at all.
Yeah, Charles, you're probably more up to date than we are on that front, though it's hard to bring charges like this and levy a fine like this, I would think, and leave it as was right on the shelves. Other accountability issues this week with Paul Wolfowitz and Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. Let's hear a little tape of the Attorney General testifying yesterday before the House Judiciary Committee, insisting he did nothing wrong in the mass firing of U.S. attorneys. His testimony coming as press reports assert that the firings of a ninth U.S. attorney happened long before was previously acknowledged. Here's Alberto Gonzalez.
It would be improper to remove a U.S. attorney to interfere with or influence a particular prosecution for partisan political gain. I did not do that. I would never do that.
And, of course, then we've got John Conyers, chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, Democrat of Michigan, saying he's exasperated with Gonzalez for his non-answers to questions.
I am, frankly, disappointed that you are unable to answer the first and most basic question of who put these U.S. attorneys on the firing list and why.
Roy Seacoff, we've still got these two dangling men and very high profile. Paul Wolfowitz at the World Bank and Alberto Gonzalez. Are these things just going to dwindle down and disappear as issues, or is the knife still out?
Oh, it's definitely still out. I mean, this is finally happening. This is the week of accountability. We saw what happened, how quickly the warp speed accountability that Chris Albrecht from HBO faced after his incident in Las Vegas.
Assault charges, and he's out. Yes, he's gone.
He's gone, and we see Paris Hilton. Paris Hilton taking accountability for go heading to jail. But Wolfowitz, I mean, he got the huge vote of no confidence from the board. And I think Gonzalez is done, but I think he's going to stay out there and take the flak as long as he can to distract where the story is really going. And I think it's going to Rove and Rove's involvement in dictating this and why these guys were fired.
Jack, do they tough it out or does it go higher and sharper?
I think that Gonzalez is going to stay, according to NPR reporting this week. The Karl Rove, who had wanted him to go, now has come around and said to the president, all right, we'll keep him around. You know, he answered a question yesterday with this. He said, I think I may be aware of that. Did you know about this? Someone asked him. Mm. I think I may be aware of that. You know, people and Republicans need to, you know, kind of face up to this. Here we have a nullus. As our attorney general, at a time when there are some huge problems in the whole administration of justice, and they're going to let him hang on there just because the Democrats don't seem to have the will to impeach him. He is eminently impeachable. He lied to Congress, and he is an incompetent, and he can't find the men's room without Karl Rove telling him where it is. And yet they're going to tough it out there. And I think the reason is they want to get one more election out of this. They want to get the 08 election with more of this, investigating quote-unquote voter fraud just before elections so as to tamp down the minority turnout. So they're leaving him in for a reason.
So there's a tough read, but one that says he doesn't go away. Dory is calling from Fairfield, Connecticut. Dory, you're on the air.
Hi, that's Fairfield, Iowa.
Oh, excuse me. Great to have you.
Yeah, actually, I'm a transplant from Connecticut. But anyway,
okay.
You kind of answered my question. I want, you know, you didn't mention initially the Gonzalez thing, and I don't want to see him get off the hot seat. So it was good that you kind of brought it back up again.
Do you think he's going to survive, or does he look like a goner to you?
Well, I hope he doesn't. And I think that I'd really be ashamed of the Democrats if they do, as they probably will, is make this a political issue. He should just be out. Let's get somebody good in there. Impeach them all.
Okay. There's the broad brush. We hear it. Trudy, you've written very tough on this in the last couple of weeks here. I mean, your column's first line, do no Bush officials ever take responsibility for their actions?
Right. I think that the Gonzalez case is quite astonishing. If he were Pinocchio, his nose would have grown out the door and around the Capitol. And everyone knows it. He's being contradicted on everything, including by the Republican-appointed U.S. attorneys who were fired. And yet, unless he's impeached, he will stay there because the president wants to keep him. And it really is disgraceful to watch. I think Wolfowitz will be pushed to resign, although he's resisting all the way, because the board at the World Bank seems to be poised to do what they don't want to do. They don't want to take an open vote saying that they have lost confidence, although a smaller group is known to have a majority against him and the overall board also. But the bank will simply stop functioning if he stays. There is an open revolt of the staff. And so probably because it's not totally under the control of the president, Wolfowitz will go. Someday, I hope that Wolfowitz is held accountable for things he did in the Iraq War.
Roy Seacoff, yeah, please.
Yeah, I mean, I'm saying that's the ironic thing. He's going to be busted because of getting a cushy situation for his girlfriend instead of leading us into Iraq with the lies. The interesting thing is we're hearing that Wolfowitz is negotiating an exit deal, actually, but he's dragging his feet because if he hangs on until June 1st, he'll become eligible for a $400,000 bonus.
So
Bush likes to talk about accountability moments. I think that's more of an accounting moment.
And what about American power? He came on the scene as an advocate of great American power. Power and wielding American power. Now, you know, there's the whole debate over whether or not the U.S. will even head up the World Bank anymore. You've got Sarkozy and Gordon Brown coming in, changes in Europe. Does Wolfowitz and the sort of perspective that he brought to Washington, Roy, actually leave Washington weaker globally?
Well, I think that's the case. I think that's the interesting thing that you've said about almost every story that we've talked about is the duplicity and the credibility, the lack of credibility that comes from whether it's saying that these jihadists were, you know, more than they were, or saying, you know, that we're going to remake the Middle East with our military might. All these things, it just lowers and lowers the credibility, and people stop listening. And I think that's the great risk.
Well, time to get real. Stakes pretty high all over the place. Roy Seacoff at the Huffington Post joining us today from Culver City, California. Roy, great to have you. Thanks very much for being here. Come again.
Love it. Thank you, Tom.
And Trudy Rubin, foreign affairs columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Trudy, we're always grateful for your eye on the world. Thanks a lot for being here today.
Great pleasure.
Jack Beatty, have a great weekend. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new turbocharged Acura RDX with available voice-activated navigation. More at acura.com/RDX.